Since 2008, NDSU Distinguished History Professor Tom Ezern has been telling stories on Prairie Public.
Historians tell stories.
His Plainsfolk essay has been a regular feature on Prairie Public's air, and this Wednesday we celebrate his 1,000th edition.
The hospitality was great.
There's something lyrical, whimsical, even magical about his essays, and they are firmly rooted in this region's history, place, and culture.
We enjoyed meals at the Prairie Rose and had unlimited supplies of Coogan, courtesy of Grandma's Coogan.
When you listen to him tell a story about a church supper in a small town on the prairie in North Dakota, you become fascinated.
That's our former director of radio, Bill Thomas, who greenlighted Plainsfolk all those years ago. He says Plainsfolk hit a sweet spot for Prairie Public's emerging statewide network.
Thoughtful, expressive stories about people and groups and churches and towns and tribes and nations in our area.
Tom Ezern's baritone, whether singing or speaking, is kind of like ranch dressing for the soul.
It's a windswept, dirt-ribbed, rock-strewn, brass-grown voice. It's a voice that anybody who's here would recognize.
We're so grateful to Tom Ezern and hope you are too. You can hear this distinctive voice of the Midwest read his 1,000th Plainsfolk, along with a Main Street chat with Craig Blumenschein this Wednesday at 3 and 7 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today we recognize that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and later in today's show, we'll highlight personal stories of survivors, advances in care, and a poetic exploration of how breast cancer can impact women's identities as shared by the Breast Cancer Monologue. And also, Prairie Public's Tay Calloway covers Theater B's production of What the Constitution Means to Me. It's a production in Moorhead, Minnesota, and is a thought-provoking play on politics with final performances this weekend. But my first guest today is Brittany Bolke-Fiecke, a physician's assistant from Essentia Health. She discusses key aspects of breast cancer awareness, including trends, myths, screening guidelines, and support for patients, recognizing what happens after a diagnosis.
Brittany, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
We're so glad that you are with us today. What's breast cancer, Brittany?
Breast cancer is when there's an abnormal growth of cells with either in the ducts that grow out into the fibrous tissue of the breast or start in the lobules and grow out into the fibrous tissue of the breast. And when that occurs, this develops into an invasive ductal or invasive lobular carcinoma.
We've all heard of breast cancer. How big a deal is it? What did the statistics say about women here in North Dakota?
So by the close of 2024, there'll be 310,000 women and 2,800 men diagnosed with breast cancer. 11% of these cases will occur in patients under the age of 45.
Is that a growing trend, Brittany, do you think, as far as younger folks experiencing breast cancer?
There is. Research published by JAMA Network Open, conducted by the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, demonstrated a steep rise in incidence of breast cancer among women between ages 20 and 49, increasing from 0.2% per year from 2000 to 2016 to 3.76% per year by the 2019. So it went from 64 to 74 cases per 100,000, which is a substantial increase in this age population.
Do we know why that is?
We are still trying to figure that out. Much of the medical community is thinking this is related to lifestyle. Some of it is related to better screening. So we're detecting more cancers at a younger age that are more manageable. But there is not one single item that we've been able to pinpoint at this time.
Do young people realize that, Brittany?
I think that with our growing ability to be in touch with the world 24 hours a day with social media and our internet and our multiple media outlets, we are able to learn more about other people's experiences. And as a result of COVID, I think a lot of people have become more aware of their health, and particularly the younger generations that are really connected to this social media world has raised their awareness.
So COVID actually has a silver lining in that regard. Yeah. Tell me, you talked about lifestyle. What does that mean?
So things that we can control are limiting our alcohol consumption. So for women, less than a glass per day, and for men, less than 2 glasses per day. And avoiding tobacco products. improving our overall health by maintaining a healthy body weight through diet and exercise can reduce the risks of cancer.
If I were to ask you, Brittany, the biggest myths people have about breast cancer.
So I think the biggest myth is that mammograms are not effective. And what we know is that the fact is mammograms save lives by detecting about 87% of breast cancers. And the sensitivity of this test certainly increases as the breast density decreases. And so the reason that is cancer looks white on a mammogram, so does dense breast tissue. And so sometimes if you have extremely dense breast tissue, we need to use additional screening images to the mammogram to help improve the ability to identify these cancers. So the FDA now requires radiologists to report out breast density. And so there's four categories of breast density. There's category A, which is fatty replaced, and that's about 10% of the population. Category B, which is fibroglandular, that's scattered, kind of scattered fibroglandular tissue in about 40% of patients. Category C is heterogeneously dense. And then category D is extremely dense. So these last two categories certainly increase the risk of breast cancer because it's more challenging to identify the cancer. But what we know is that that extremely dense breast tissue, actually those folks have double the risk of those intermediate categories to developing breast cancer because more glandular tissue leads to the greater potential for cancer to be developed. And that is why men, while they can be diagnosed with breast cancer, tend to have a less incidence than women because they have less glandular tissue because they're not having the potential to breastfeed. But every person born does have breast tissue with the potential to have a breast cancer.
Just so our listeners will know, we're going to talk to a male breast cancer survivor tomorrow on Main Street. I'm really looking forward to that conversation. What about folks who say, okay, I can't afford an MRI, Brittany. I'm not going to be able to afford what she's talking about. Maybe I'll continue self-examinations, which we can talk about here in just a moment. But what message would you give to those, to people that are listening that are just really worried about cost of even this early detection scenario that's so important?
So for North Dakota, there's a program called Women's Way, supported by the government, that would provide free breast and cervical cancer screenings for those that qualify that are uninsured or of low income. So you can reach out to them at 701-298-6918 to determine if you are a candidate for their service. The other program in Minnesota is called SAGE, and they can be reached at 651-201-5600. And that would also provide you the option within either state to potentially undergo breast screening or cervical cancer screening if you're not able to do so with your financial means.
Anecdotally, I've heard that genetics do play a role in women who experience breast cancer. Is that what you see, and is that what the research bears out?
So about 15% of breast cancers are related to the BRCA1 or 2 gene. And the reason that this is important to identify if you are a gene carrier is that by the age of 70, 65% of BRCA1 mutation carriers and 45% of BRCA2 mutation carriers will develop breast cancer.
And that could be much before age 70, but in the statistics, that's what you're saying.
Correct, by the age of 70. And so for these folks, they're at a heightened risk beyond just what a dense breast tissue person has risk. So we use a Gale model calculator or a TI-Curix, which is the updated version of how we determine what a person's breast cancer risk is. And so that's based on a person's age, race, genetics, ethnicity, body mass index, family history, personal breast history, and any personal high-risk lesions that have been found on breast biopsy, like atypical ductal hyperplasia or lobular carcinoma in situ. And so if a person's risk is greater than 20% in a lifetime, then they would be a candidate for additional screening, so like a mammogram, alternating with MRI every 6 months. So for BRCA mutation carriers, because they're at heightened risk, they are also candidates for these screening with MRI and mammogram. The difference is, for our BRCA mutation carriers, we're recommending they start screening by the age of 30 or 10 years younger than their youngest family member that has been diagnosed.
Does insurance support that also, Brittany?
They do support that. when they recognize this heightened risk and do approve MRIs and cover them. You know, coverage for each insurance company varies, so we certainly advise patients to reach out to their insurance companies before proceeding with the MRI because they are quite expensive.
How can someone decide then? Is that through a blood test that they carry the genes?
So insurance requires patients to meet with a genetic counselor to assess their family history and make sure that they qualify. So that means that having first or second degree relatives with a cancer, so breast, colon, prostate, melanoma, and ovarian cancer all sit on these BRCA genes. And while they're not the only genes that can increase the risk of cancer, they're the ones that I think we've heard the most about. So the genetic counselor will assess what genes are most appropriate for you to be tested for, and usually it's just a broad panel that insurance will cover if you have a mother, a grandmother, a brother, a sister that has been diagnosed, or grandfather, that has been diagnosed with one of these cancers.
You mentioned earlier race, Brittany. What does race mean in breast cancer detection and the number of folks who have breast cancer or who are diagnosed with breast cancer?
So what we found is that 5% of white women and 10% of black women are diagnosed with breast cancer in their 40s, which is a pretty astounding number.
It is an astounding number.
When the average lifetime risk of a woman to develop breast cancer without any of these heightened risk factors is about 13% in their lifetime. But what we found is that black women, compared to their white counterparts, are 40% more likely to die from their breast cancer. And, you know, a lot of this disparage is not fully understood, whether it's lack of access to resources or genetics that are playing a role. But in April of 2014, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force had updated their recommendation to initiate mammograms at age 40. Their prior recommendation was to begin between ages 40 and 50, whereas the American Cancer Society and the National Comprehensive Cancer Network has always pushed for women to begin mammograms by the age of 40. So the task force has acknowledged that there's been a change in data and science, and we're finding that younger women are being diagnosed, and we're also finding that the task force is acknowledging that there might need to be different screening recommendations for our black patients because of their heightened risk of diagnosis at a younger age.
We're enjoying our conversation with Brittany Bolke-Fiecke. We are talking about breast cancer and the services that are available to folks who live right here in North Dakota. Brittany, what about treatment? What's changed over the years? Are we getting better at treating what can be a devastating disease?
The American Association for Cancer Research's annual report released in September points to a rapid shift in cancer landscape with more people surviving cancer. The death rate has decreased by a third from 1991 to 2021. 3 decades ago, 1.4% of the population was composed of people with a diagnosis. Now, 5% of the American population is composed of either someone who carries a diagnosis of cancer or is currently battling cancer, which equates to 18 million people being alive.
Are screenings getting better? Is that why those numbers are increasing?
So screenings are improving. As I mentioned, we now have 3D mammograms versus 2D mammograms, which gives us a better view of breast tissue. We have the ability to add in MRI or ultrasound if needed to look at suspicious areas and determine if there's been changes over time. Additionally, we're able to tailor our treatments more towards the patient's cancer and not just the disease state. And we do that by biomarkers and genomic testing. So this is really more precision medicine, giving you the best we have available to identify in breast cancer HER2, and these BRCA genes have now equated to more treatment options for patients.
Brittany, help me understand what the word remission means. I've heard that a lot, and I've heard in my own family that I'm in remission, and 2 or 3 years later, my aunt died from her cancer, yet things were looking so good. What does that mean that someone's in remission?
So remission to us in medical oncology means that the cancer is not actively growing or not maybe visible on imaging. A lot of us use the term no evidence of cancer when we know that there's a potential risk for a cancer to grow or return, metastasize in the future. So unfortunately, cancer can become smart over time. If we've had cells that are left behind and can grow, the biology of that cancer can evolve and become resistant to the treatments that we've been currently having success with or had success with before taking a break from treatment.
Brittany, take me into your office when you are sitting down with a patient and for the first time they're hearing from you, you have breast cancer. What next do you usually say?
So usually we start to talk about what that means. And I like to draw a picture because I think words can be really confusing. So drawing a picture, and I'm no artist, but patients can understand what the difference is between a duct and a lobule, and explaining where their tumor originated and where it grew to, I think helps give a patient a visual of what went on in their body. And then we lead into the discussion of what is the stage of the cancer.
And what does that mean also? Can you help me with that? Mm-hmm.
So the stage is based on the location and the size of the tumor, as well as has it spread into lymph nodes or spread from the lymph nodes to the bloodstream to another organ in the body. So for example, breast cancer has the risk of metastasizing most commonly to the lungs, the liver, and the bones, and occasionally the brain. And so stage one would be it's confined to the breast. Stage two means it's a little bit larger tumor and typically confined to the breast or maybe one or two lymph nodes. Stage three means there's a pretty good sized tumor in the breast and potentially there's a multiple lymph nodes enlarged in the underarm. And stage four means it spread from outside the breast to the lymph nodes and to another site. So like the lungs, the liver, or the bones.
And then decisions need to be made.
So typically, when patients come to see us in medical oncology, they've already had their mammogram and ultrasound, and they've had a biopsy to tell them that this area in question, in fact, is cancer. And then they meet with a surgeon, and the surgeon helps them determine if they're a candidate for a lumpectomy, which means they get to just have the tumor removed and some healthy tissue around it to make sure there's no residual cancer, or if they need a mastectomy, which means the whole breast is removed. And sometimes it comes down to patient preference. The surgeon will also talk about whether lymph nodes from the underarm need to be assessed, which means we take out a couple lymph nodes and look at them to see if the cancer spread. And then based on that finding, that they meet with us. And then we determine in medical oncology, do we need to do additional imaging to look at the rest of the body? So a PET scan or a CAT scan.
In my family, then after the diagnosis happened and after a mastectomy occurred, the decision was breast reconstruction. Is that generally covered by insurance today? And are those difficult decisions for women?
It is definitely covered by insurance. I think it is a challenging decision to make for women. For one point, that most women would like to preserve their normal anatomy as much as possible or return to a close to their normal anatomy. Some women would prefer not have to manage a reconstruction because that does require extra surgeries, extra risk of potential infection, plus extra healing. But it's really a personal decision, and there has been no influence on cancer itself by choosing to or not to undergo reconstruction.
We had a dear friend who decided after she received her diagnosis that I'm going to fight this the natural way, and did her best to do that and ultimately succumbed then to breast cancer later. What message do you give to folks who really want to take control of their own care to the extent that it ignores maybe advice about more, I don't want to use the word serious, but more recommended treatments from an oncologist or for someone like you, Brittany?
At this point, the alternative options that we've seen have not been processed through a clinical trial, which is how we base all of our scientific evidence and information we provide to patients. So I really do encourage patients to think about where the information is they've learned this alternative option. Sometimes it's something that can be used in adjunct to our traditional Western medicine. Sometimes we just don't know if it's going to harm or adversely affect what we're doing, so then we'll advise against it. But ultimately, it comes down to a person's own beliefs and wishes.
How does the United States do compared to other countries in treating breast cancer? Do you have any thoughts about that or any data about that that says, you know what, we do pretty well?
we do do well. I don't have the statistics in front of me to compare us to the other countries around the world, but I know that each country is striving to give the optimal care to breast cancer patients.
Sure, sure. How important have you witnessed, noticed support is for someone who has been diagnosed with breast cancer from family and friends? How can they best support their loved one?
So I think the best way you can support them is, you know, through words of encouragement, prayer, if that's something that you believe in. Sometimes it's just providing them a meal or a ride and just a listening ear. Because sometimes I hear from cancer patients that there's a lot of advice that's given from loved ones, and we all want our loved ones to be well cared for, but sometimes they just would prefer to have someone listen to them.
There are others, and I think I fall into this category, that say, well, you know what? I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm going to do this alone. What advice would you give to people like me who are stubborn in that way?
Well, it's really a personal decision, because it's all about your comfort level, but there are lots of people that care about these patients that want to go it alone. And they would, I think, be really humbled and appreciative of all the love and support they would get and receive from the people they care about if they would open up a little to them.
We talked about myths a little bit earlier, and I guess I want to dive a little bit deeper into that, Brittany, if I can. There's a lot of stuff online, a lot of stuff. And I'm guessing a lot of stuff that instructs women on how to self-exam. What would you tell women? How do you educate women in the best way to do that?
So choosing a day a month that's easy for you to remember to examine all of your breast tissue. There's really no right or wrong way. It's really becoming aware of what your skin looks like overlying your breasts, what it feels like when you're examining it. So touching all the ways from your underarm, all the ways across to where your sternum or your breastbone is, across the whole area where you have breast tissue, and looking for any changes in redness, skin puckering or dimpling, nipple retraction or discharge from the nipple. Those things should all alert a person to seek medical care to have those changes examined.
And I want to review before we go, Brittany, we have a couple minutes left, the most current guidelines on how young people, people with a genetic history, people with no history in their families, what should they do and when should they do it?
So again, the screening recommendation from the American Cancer Society is to begin for average risk women by the age of 40 with annual mammograms. For those that are heightened risk, you know, greater than 20% lifetime risk of breast cancer diagnosis, usually by the age of 30, they should begin mammograms alternating with breast MRI if they choose that to be appropriate for their health and their well-being, because they have to be aware that there is about a 30% false positive rate with MRI. So there is some apprehension and anxiety that can come with having to wait for a biopsy that potentially will turn out to be normal. And then for those BRCA gene mutation carriers or any other genetic mutation carrier, they really should start screening 10 years younger than their youngest relative that was diagnosed.
One more thing I want to cover, Brittany. We've talked about surgical options. We didn't talk about chemotherapy options. I assume that there are many, and that's very important relative to care.
Yeah, so after we get that imaging back, then that helps us determine, or there's a test called an oncotype that we will send on breast tissue if a person falls into that category that will help us determine if chemotherapy is useful in helping reduce the likelihood of a recurrence of cancer. And so most of those are IV chemotherapies. For those patients that have metastatic cancer, we have oral chemotherapy drug options as well as IV, and they've become much less toxic, so they're more tolerable, side effects are better managed, we have less of this constant vomiting or diarrhea that was the traditional thought associated with chemotherapy.
Chemotherapy is scary to many, but you're saying it's better treated today.
It is.
And Brittany, what about radiation?
Some folks require radiation following chemotherapy based on having a lumpectomy or a large size tumor. Some folks would not require it based on age guidelines. So that would be something that would be evaluated with the radiation oncologist after the completion of chemotherapy.
I would assume that radiation therapy may have less side effects than chemotherapy. Is that true?
In most cases, that is true. Most of the time, the biggest issue is some fatigue associated with the treatment, as well as some skin changes that can occur where the radiation's directed, which typically heals within a few weeks after the completion of radiation.
Brittany Bolke-Fiecke, thank you so much for joining us here on Main Street and with the message of breast cancer awareness is just so important.
Thank you so much for having me, Craig. Have a great day.
Coming up, personal stories of survivors of breast cancer. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Facing a breast cancer diagnosis can be overwhelming, but support services have improved significantly in the last decade. In this PRX story from WSKG, we hear from breast cancer survivors as they reflect on their experiences and the crucial support that helped them through their treatment.
When a person is faced with a major illness, care is needed for more than the body and the disease. Financial concerns, the often overwhelming schedule of appointments, and the emotional stresses are difficult to get through. Fortunately, this has been recognized as a critical part of care, and improved support is now available and affordable in many areas.
When I was first going to the doctors, I mean, I had my mom, my sister, Sharon, everybody took notes, because I'd be sitting there going, you know, I have no idea what you're talking about. You shut down real quick.
I spoke with breast cancer survivor Kat Forsyth.
I mean, I'm sitting here now, and I can't believe I actually went through all this stuff because, like, between my family and, I mean, Sharon took the reins. I mean, if it wasn't for her, my financial issues would have been just out of control. And that's where Healthy Living Partnership came in also. They came to me at work and helped fill out paperwork. And next thing I knew, I had emergency Medicaid for 5 years.
Beth Slater, a representative of the Healthy Living Partnership in New York State.
So the good thing about our program is if somebody says, oh, well, if I actually had a diagnosis, what would I do? I wouldn't be able to pay for it anyway. And the great thing about Healthy Living Partnership is if you are diagnosed and screened through our program, you may be eligible for a program called the Medicaid treatment, which would allow you to have Medicaid during the course of treatment, and the eligibility guidelines are much different than Medicaid's for people who fall in between the cracks and may not be eligible for Medicaid or don't have insurance. So people may be eligible for treatment through the program as well.
Kat Forsyth.
Just knowing that there's somebody that's got your name on file, they know you've got a history, they know you need mammograms, they know that you're uninsured, and they can pull that file out and say, well, we're going to call her just to make sure she doesn't slip on this, mm-hmm. you know.
A woman has family, friends to talk to. They have their doctor to talk to. We also set our patients up with the Stay Healthy Center nurses.
Susan Cost, director of the Breast Care Center at Wilson Hospital in Binghamton, New York.
We have a breast cancer companion program where the nurse will call patients periodically throughout her course of treatment at key moments, like right after she visited the oncologist, or maybe just before she visits the oncologist, to help get a list of questions to ask. The patient can also call her nurse in this nurse companion program. So there's a two-way calling system. We like to follow our patients that first year because I think there are gaps in time where women just need to talk to another woman and get some questions answered, or maybe to a nurse who she feels very comfortable with that knows her. And we can do this through phone calls.
Tell me about the system called nurse navigation.
Nurse navigation is a concept that a patient will come in and nurses will follow her through. She'll come in for the test, but the nurse will continue to guide her each step of the way. And it was really pioneered in breast centers for breast cancer patients because there were so many hurdles patients had to jump. They had to get through the diagnostics and then through biopsy and then move through surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. And while they had wonderful doctors working with them every step of the way, sometimes there were gaps of time where nobody was with them and they felt uncomfortable calling. So nurse navigators, what we do at Wilson Hospital is, if additional testing is needed, our nurses will call her, will gently explain the reasons why, we'll bring them back quickly. It takes us usually a day or two to get them back. And we believe the speed of that helps with the anxiety. While she's there, we'll do the mammogram or the ultrasound. We'll have the radiologist read it and give her results right then and there. Again, the anxiety is reduced because we know what we're dealing with. We try to look at every step of the way of imaging to diagnosis and make it a very sensitive, caring place for a woman.
My name is Bob Ritter, and I'm the Associate Director of the Ithaca Breast Cancer Alliance. And I got involved with breast cancer work because I have breast cancer. I was diagnosed 11 years ago now, and I found a small lump under my left nipple one night. I was just in bed scratching my chest, and I felt something that felt like a pencil eraser. And I just thought that seemed odd, but didn't give it too much thought. But then I had some bleeding from that nipple. It first really surprised me because I didn't know that men had a working orifice in the nipple. And suddenly I had blood coming out. So surprised me. And yeah, of course, I went to see my family doctor very quickly. And he was good. He said that although it's rare, men get breast cancer too. And he said, if you were a woman with these symptoms, we take it seriously. And we will for you too. Which is really good because I've talked to some men who did not get that response. But it's essentially the same disease. In fact, under the microscope, you can't tell the difference. And for the most part, you know, treatment's the same, prognosis is the same. It's just much more rare in men. People shouldn't go through cancer alone because it's incredibly stressful. Cancer affects so many different people.
I think a lot of pats on the back should be going out to the caregivers, too.
Kat Forsyth.
You know, and of course, Sharon went through watching her mother slowly decline from it, and then I come up with it, and it's, you know, it's just opening a whole new can of worms for her.
Kat Forsyth's friend and advocate, Sharon Solomon.
My mother's gone 14 years, and it's still too painful and difficult for me to even talk about it, what we went through. She was sick for 2 years, and at the end, the last 6 months of her life, my sister and I took care of her every day. She was bedridden. It could take as much as 3 years for a caregiver's immune system to return to normal after taking care of someone who was passed on like that. That's how much it compromises your immune system on the caregiver from the stress of it all, you know, just mental, physical. And I remember the doctor said, if you want to do this, you know, it's fine. Like I said, we went home with hospice and my sister and I taking sole care of her. And he said, there will be many nights that he said, you'll go out on the porch and just want to scream till you can't scream anymore. Because he said, it is not easy. But that's okay.
It's the most definite, all-defining type of thing to happen to somebody. Because you don't just get cancer. Everybody
right.
around you gets it,
the whole
too.
The family does.
Support groups for both caregivers and patients are available through the American Cancer Society and many hospitals.
One of the important questions is simply, how can we help you? Is it educational? Is it a support group?
Bob Nugent, Senior Director of Cancer Control at the American Cancer Society's Eastern Division.
We have a program called Reach to Recovery, where we match diagnosed breast cancer patients with folks who have had the diagnosis and have been through the treatments. Mm-hmm. So it is a real connection. Our facilitators are trained to listen and to be able to interact with those newly diagnosed patients. And it's a healthy and positive experience for both sides. One of the important things is, as you are diagnosed or newly diagnosed patient, please know you are not alone and there are people out there willing to help you and talk. And I think that is one of the more difficult challenges for the newly diagnosed, to reach out and really take a deep breath and ask the question, now who do I talk to and where do I get information? And that's what the American Cancer Society is really set up for.
Breast Care and Update series is made possible through a grant from the Susan G. Komen Foundation. For WSKG, I'm Kathleen Cook.
The Fargo Public Library presents their Fall into Jazz concerts featuring local jazz artists Sundays, October 6th through the 27th, starting at 2 p.m. at the Downtown Main Library. More information at fargolibrary.org.
Main Street continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We're continuing our breast cancer awareness program, and we have a collection of poems called My Body, My Temple, which informs us on how breast cancer affects women's lives and identities. This piece originally aired as part of the Breast Cancer Monologues and features poetry written and performed by women living with breast cancer.
Mi templo, mi cuerpo es un templo, es un lugar que puedo contemplar la belleza, el misterio y los tesoros por descubrir. Es un lugar que invita, me invita a apreciar diferentes pasajes en mi vida. Es un lugar sagrado que invita a mi mente, mi cuerpo y mi espíritu a estar en cohesión. Mi cuerpo es mi templo donde yo encuentro paz, dolor, soledad y amor.
My body, my temple. It's my source to the spirit, but I am so easily swayed toward mistreatment, the worries, the stress, the lack of sleep, the desire for alternating states of mind. But if I'm centered, if I'm relaxed and well rested, my body leads me to the source, the well, the life spring. I have difficulty staying there. I want to shift and fidget. I want to move and flex. I don't want to believe in or trust my body. It's my source of grace, and yet it's my source of pain. It flows with ease and beauty, but it wears scars and marks of abuse. It guides me gently, and yet it leads me astray. Is my body a vehicle for some laughing god?
As I lay on the table, my heart rose to my throat. I felt panic. The man guiding the ultrasound was getting intense. His directions were sharp. Over there. No, move it over there.
Before breast cancer, I looked at my breasts as an attraction, meaning they represented a sexual thing to men. After the diagnosis of breast cancer, I saw them as an enemy to my own body. It took me months to look at myself after the lumpectomy and lymph node removal. Initially, the biopsy was actually harder than the surgery, not counting recovery. For the biopsy, I was awake for it. The surgeon seemed to be pulling and tugging on my left breast. I had to keep asking for more pain meds because I could feel it. It was very uncomfortable.
It's my source of grace, and yet it's my source of pain.
Pain, reaching causes pain. Pain, resting in pain. How does this body work? In grief and anguish, my body feels the pain, and in pain, I learn to care about my body. My body, which has cared for me, carried me so well so many times. My body says, this is too much pain.
Numb, what do I do? The cancer takes over. You've got to deal with it. Cope.
I don't want to believe in or trust my body. It will betray me.
The surgery, it was easy as I was put out. Didn't feel a thing. I remember waking up and asking the nurse if they had to take the whole breast or not. I was relieved I still had both of them.
The doctor says, let go of the pain. How does one do that? The pain is real, and let go of the pain. And so I begin to breathe into the pain, accept the pain, and let it go. Accept and let go.
It hurt to move my upper body, and it was painful to raise my head up when I was lying down. I cried a lot, more than I ever had, just weeping.
And so I begin to breathe into the pain, accept the pain, and let it go.
I went into menopause as my cancer was estrogen receptive. So the first thing they did was take me off my estrogen.
Accept and let go.
I didn't look at my body for months. It made me feel very undesirable, like no one would ever want to be with me again. I haven't been with a man since before the surgery in the year 2000.
How does this body work?
It's like a button has been turned off, and I worry it will never be turned on again.
How does this body work?
I visualize myself, though, as I used to look. The hard part about that is the reality check I get when I look in the mirror and see how others see me now.
Accept and let go.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra continues its season Dreamscapes with Gift of Dreams on October 19th at the Balmejhus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. Tchaikovsky's riveting Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture is paired with the provocative Ratavara concerto, Gift of Dreams, performed by pianist Andrew Stope. More information and tickets can be found online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Theater V is a small, not-for-profit theater in Moorhead, Minnesota, with a large voice. During their fall season, the company is performing a play about politics and the conversations around it. Here's Prairie Public's Tay Calloway's story, How Do We Play Well with others.
Radio is often called the theater of the mind. All the elements in a radio story set the stage. The music, the environment, and the voice can take you on a trip. We can go back and listen to the 1940s.
I'll always love you.
You have to have lots of energy. And the swellest way I know to get it is just by eating delicious chocolatey Tootsie Rolls.
The 70s. And nowhere. We could just sit here and talk. Or you could listen to me talk and think. And ask larger questions like, do dogs know they drink their own backwash? And if aliens saw that we put pineapples on pizza, would they destroy us? Or we could ask questions about ourselves and the world around us, which is what the theater does. And it has me wondering, what draws us to the stage? Besides the big name actors, the musicals, the costumes, and the ticket price, what keeps us in our seats during the intermission?
I have always been fascinated by and drawn towards, how do we play well with others?
So I went to the stage so I can see what I could learn. The voice you just heard was John Michael Leeses, the artistic director at Theater B. He's currently running a production for What Does the Constitution Mean to Me? By Heidi Shirk. If you haven't heard of What Does the Constitution Mean to Me? Then it's important to know that this play speaks about politics and some of the issues that are affecting us now, like abortion, rights and whose rights are protected, election, and what might we do to go about creating the Constitution of tomorrow? It's heavy, and it's a conversation in recent years many of us have been shying away from.
Our mission is to ignite transformative conversations in the community. We ask big questions, and we...
That's Monica Brown-Ecker. She's the new managing director at Theater B. Her and John are working together to produce this play.
When you see a production that's made it onto Theater B's season, it's the result of those kind of community conversations that have been already happening.
And so conversation is really important, and hopefully it's a beginning to something. Not just the thinking, but also maybe some doing.
I'm here tonight to dig deeper into a big question about our founding document. Is it protecting us, or is it the source for our problems?
And what the Constitution means to me, there's a lot of talk.
Heidi loved this contest. It made her value her own mind and also believe that people would listen
to
her when she spoke.
Under the original terms of this document, you are the only
Let me say that the Constitution is not a crucible. At least, that's not how I
look. We have 2 minutes.
Good evening.
Time.
I'm gonna cry.
Starts now.
It's a discussion on a subject that has somehow become taboo in this country built on conversations. We don't really talk anymore. It's just you're right or you're wrong, the nitpicking and everything other than talking to understand one another. But being in the theater changes that.
Because theater is live, you feel it differently than you do when you watch a movie. You're experiencing the same things that the characters are experiencing. And being an audience member was the beginning of it for me.
When we're in front of the stage and we're an audience to the story and all those around us taking in everyone's laughter, cries, gasps, tears, and subtle movements, we realize the difference between us, the space that lies before us and beside us that separates us is really just arm's length away.
And from that comes the feeling that we're not alone. And that, I think, is the most valuable experience that theater can bring us. That relief that we are not alone in the world. There are other people who feel, think, do similar things that other humans do.
So while, yes, you can come to a Theater B performance and you can be amused and you can laugh and you can even escape into another world, at the end of the day, we choose our productions and we make our art so that all of us, audience members, artists, everybody who's involved in the production, will return to our own lives. The goal is differently. to see our own lives differently, to have those kinds of conversations, to enter into our civic spaces, to enter into our family relationships, to, you know, go about our daily same old in a new way because we've been changed by this theater experience.
It's beautiful to have a space where we can all come together and share an experience, feeling different emotions and make different faces and still be together. So when John says,
I have always been fascinated by and drawn towards, how do we play well with others? How do we play well with others?
What he's saying is,
that I am fascinated with watching people and listening to people and looking at what they do and finding their particular strengths and their hungers and their passions, what drives them. And then finding processes and environments where we can get that at the same table in order to collaborate together.
Theater is all about collaboration and bringing different artists and talents together to ask a lot of questions. Sometimes we're given an answer, and sometimes we're left to think on it ourselves. With everything that is happening in our lives, politics, work, relationships, and friendships, we need to ask ourselves, how do we play well with others? How do we find and take those strengths, differences, and passions and place them in a sandbox to create a better future? And if that's too forward thinking, then at least a better tomorrow.
Prairie Public's Take Calloway with the story of Theater B in Moorhead's production of What the Constitution Means to Me, which is coming up on its final weekend this Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m., with a matinee Sunday at 2 p.m. You can find more information at theaterb.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 15th. In 1941, the Black Seaport of Odessa had been surrounded by German troops for several weeks, and on this date, the city's Russian troops evacuated. The region figures heavily in North Dakota history. In the early 1900s, thousands of German Russians immigrated to the United States, with large numbers settling in North Dakota. When the Germans in Russia were forced to enter the military to fight against their native Germany, a new mass migration began, this time to the United States, with a large number settling in central and southwestern North Dakota. The choice to stay or go wasn't an easy one. Germans had created thriving farms and businesses in separate communities that allowed them to retain their culture and language. Even as they became more and more threatened, many were reluctant to leave. By the 1920s, the ones who stayed behind were considered enemies of the state, and their lives became a living hell. Another who remained in Russia was Johann Schauer. In a 1993 letter to relatives, he wrote, "Until the beginning of the Second World War, we lived in Neudorf, Odessa. I was drafted into the Red Russia Army. I was wounded and was 2 years in a POW camp in Germany. After that, they made me a Russian translator in the German Army. And I was always close to the front. Then I became a soldier in the German Army and fought to the end of the war. I had to fight against the Russians in Russia." When Johann tried to find his parents after the war, they were no longer in Odessa. In 1944, they had been allowed to leave their farm, but had to leave everything behind except what would fit into their horse-drawn wagon. They made it to Poland, but the following year, the Russians sent them to a Siberian slave labor camp, the tragic fate of thousands of German Russians. Johann found them there, but he ended up getting arrested and jailed for 5 years for having served in the German army. In 1988, Johann and his family were finally able to move to Germany, but ironically, they were unwelcome. Johann wrote, "From 1945 to 1988, we were always the German fascists in Russia, but now in Germany, here we are the Russians among the Germans. Many of our children can't speak German because the German language was not allowed in Russia after the war. For many years, Germans from Russia weren't allowed to communicate with Americans, but as that ban has lifted, more and more German Russians are connecting with distant family members in North Dakota." Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm. I'm Anne Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public. And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow, we are looking forward to our conversation with Dr. Tom Easern from North Dakota State University. He's a distinguished professor of history, and if you've heard him once, maybe you've heard him 1,000 times. Tomorrow, I'll visit with Dr. Easern, and he'll read his 1,000th Plains Folk essay, and you've heard them all right here on Prairie Public. That's a conversation I am really looking forward to with our longtime friend. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.